This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A former Cincinnati mayor attacks the current mayor in newly revealed text messages sent to city council members. What's the story behind this breakdown in a once cordial and friendly relationship? And possession of 100 grams of marijuana is decriminalized in the city. We'll look at what that means. And a local police leader reacts to a disturbing spike in violence. The Friday News Review begins now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Dan Horn. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
And WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Welcome, Jay.
Hi there.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation today. You can also email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those in the show as well. We were supposed to be joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich as well, but he's busy right now at a zoning appeals board meeting involving trees. So, Jay, I'm going to ask you to lift from Chris's reporting a little bit and just give us an overview on what's happening, because people are probably concerned about this.
Clearly, I'm not at the hearing, so we're going to borrow Chris's material. Basically, this involves a fight over four 50-year-old trees in Lytle Park along 4th Street. Western and Southern is funding an overhaul of the park, or part of an overhaul of the park, and they want them removed. Some neighbors want them to stay. Originally, according to Chris's reporting, the Park Board of Commissioners wanted them to stay, but then under pressure from Western Southern, since they're paying for part of the rehab of the park, they decided to go along, and the Historic Conservation Board, this is a whole lot of boards, went along with the Park Board that these trees could be removed. The neighbors have now filed an appeal with the Zoning Board of Appeals, and that's what's being heard right now. And whatever comes of this today probably is not the end. These cases usually end up in Hamilton County Common Pleas Court, so whichever side is not victorious today will probably end up in court to keep fighting.
So the story's ongoing, more than likely.
Right.
And the green grass grows all around and around, and the green grass grows
It'll branch out.
All right. Well, let's move on to new parts of an old story now. It's text messages from City Hall. This time we know more about messages involving former Mayor Dwight Tillery and remarks about current Mayor John Cranley. Dan, what did you find in these text messages?
Well, it was a pretty interesting read. You don't often get a window into this kind of communication that goes on. And let's face it, this kind of communication probably goes on quite a bit among elected officials and powerful people in town. So because these were a part of a public records fight, it kind of gave us a window into what these things look like. And in this case, we had a former mayor, Dwight Tillery, having communications with someone on council who is interested in becoming the next mayor at P.G. Sittenfeld, along with other council members, talking about the current mayor, John Cranley. So it's a very interesting mix there. And generally what was happening was that P.G. Sittenfeld and four other councilmen were very involved in the effort to protect former city manager Harry Black when Mayor John Cranley was engaged in an effort to oust him some time ago last year. And Dwight Tillery, it turns out, was very involved in those conversations, very involved in the strategy that was going on behind the scenes about how they should approach this and how they should publicly make their case that Harry Black should stay. And some of it got pretty ugly. The comments were pretty blunt. It was the kind of conversation that happens when you assume no one else is paying attention, no one else is listening, and no one else is going to see it. And so the former mayor, Dwight Tillery, said some pretty harsh things about John Cranley. He's a former friend. He used to support his campaigns. That is long gone. They had a falling out some time ago, and that was very evident from these texts.
So we've been talking about text messages out of Cincinnati City Hall for months now,
right?
And this is often referred to as the Gang of Five case because of the five city council members that were involved in some group chatting. Why now are we just seeing these messages?
Well, there have been a number of public records requests made over the last year related to all these conversations around Harry Black. You know, we've made some at the Inquirer. Other media outlets have made them as well. Brian Shrive, a local attorney, has made many of them. This was part of his requests. And they have trickled out as the city has fought and lost cases to protect them. And this batch happened to come out this week. And, the courts have generally held that these conversations about city business, even if they take place on private phones, are public and they should be released. And so they are out. And there's a lot of debate about whether that's the right call or not, but they are out. And so we get this unusual view into, these kind of behind-the-scenes conversations.
Tillery referred to Cranley as a bully a rogue mayor, a maniac, a racist, crazy, corrupt, engages in gangster tactics, and, quote, a crafty little, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this word on Cincinnati Public Radio, but think Jon Snow before we knew he was Aegon Targaryen. So that's the word that you'll want to associate here for that.
Right.
And Tillery was sharing these opinions with council members. And you just referenced this, Dan. I'm wondering, what happened to this relationship between Tillery and Cranley? And Jay, you can weigh in on this as well, because they were friends. Tillery was a supporter of Cranley, and now
he co-chaired his original 2013 mayoral campaign.
This is before Tillery decided that Cranley was a, quote, maniac.
Right. Well, the initial falling out, we believe, had a lot to do with the Cincinnati Health Commission and the dispute over who should be the next commissioner. And things did not end well there. And there are obviously are more than policy differences between these two at this point. And whatever they are, that's probably mostly between them. But when you see these kinds of comments, that goes beyond, I disagree on the choices you make and the policies you make. These are very personal opinions, obviously. So that relationship does not seem repairable at this point.
And let's remember, Dwight Tillery is now the former, he was the founder, now the former head of the Center for Closing the Health Gap. He has since retired from that post. But when John Cranley was elected mayor, he was a big supporter of the Center for Closing the Health Gap. Matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago, one of the public speakers at Cincinnati City Hall actually held his iPhone up to the microphone and played a video that Mayor Cranley had taped supporting the Center for Closing the Health Gap and what a good institution it was and how important of an institution it was. And then, you know, a couple years later, the mayor was saying that there shouldn't be any funding for the Center for Closing the Health Gap unless it goes through the city's regular processes for funding human services organizations.
So what is Mayor Cranley saying about all this now?
Not much. He has not commented publicly beyond the statement he gave us for this story, where he basically denied that, you know, any of the allegations that Mr. Tillery had made in these texts were true. He basically said that he's been treated unfairly, that these comments tell a lot more about Mr. Tillery than about him, and that he also indicated that he believes that shows that he was behind a lot of these Gang of Five strategies and efforts, and that he was kind of, you know, making a lot of that stuff happen behind the scenes. How much of that's true, but that doesn't mean these folks wouldn't have been doing what they were doing with or without Mr. Tillery's involvement.
One of the interesting messages from Dwight Tillery was a warning of civil unrest. What did he mean by that?
Well, he, you know, in the context of these texts, he was speaking broadly about the potential implications of the ouster of a high-ranking African-American official like Mr. Black. And so his argument was that if this happens, especially coming not so long after the ouster of former police chief Blackwell, that, you know, you could have a good number of people in the community pretty upset about that. And he was suggesting that that could take the form of public disobedience, possible civil unrest. Now, obviously, some folks take that as a threat. Other people think he's just stating what he believes would happen if Black loses his job. But that certainly was discussed. Now, in fairness to Mr. Sittenfeld and the other council members on this, they did not engage him to any great degree regarding those issues. They did not encourage that. He would bring it up, and typically there wouldn't be a response that we were able to see, at least in the text, to that particular claim.
What about other members of council? Have they reacted to this new batch of text messages?
No one's saying a lot.
Right? I haven't seen anything.
So there's a little bit of text message fatigue, it seems like.
I think that is setting in, yeah.
Well, I want to note this because we do spend a lot of time or have spent a lot of time so far this year talking about text messages and who's saying what about whom at Cincinnati City Hall. But despite all that infighting or the traditional debate that's taking place on various pieces of legislation at City Hall, a new poll came out this week. It was commissioned by the Port Authority. It was of 400 likely 2020 Hamilton County primary voters. It was conducted in late April and early May. And we should note that 59% of those voters approve of the job that John Cranley is doing as mayor, compared to 37% who disapprove, and 54% also approve of the job that city council is doing, compared with 42% who disapprove. So those numbers indicate that in spite of all of this and some of the reactions that you'll see on social media to various issues, that overall they seem to have pretty solid approval ratings, although it doesn't note whether the majority of these voters are actually in the city proper. It may just be.
No, I think Chris Wetterick, and this has been another area where Chris has been good to talk about this. I think Chris noted in his story that they only asked the city voters.
Oh, perfect.
That reflects the opinion of city voters.
Right. Exactly. And then county voters overall, because we know that the county commissioners have been involved in some relationship or some by government pieces of legislation. So 55% also approve of the job that the Hamilton County Commission is doing. And goodness knows they've had their own issues recently with who's getting along with whom there.
But you have to think that they would have to be pretty. I mean, you know, that's a pretty good number, as you said, with everything that we've heard with the text messages. You know, there's always the joke of city council and things that don't go well at City Hall, but those are pretty strong approval numbers, overall for everything that has been going on.
It sounds like the adage that everybody hates Congress but loves their congressman. So 513-419-7100 is the number to call. We've got Shakur on the line. Hi, Shakur. What's your question or comment?
Hey, Mr. Monk, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
I would like to ask, you know, as a taxpayer, it's been so much energy put into the text messaging, and out of respect for the reporters and Channel 9 News, why haven't these entities put that same energy in finding out what was in John Cranley's text message and the one, the phone that all of a sudden fell in the hot tub, and just be a little bit more fair? Because believe me when I tell you this, and not the sole speaker for the black community, but we very understand how the media works. And it just seemed like it's so slanted, sir. And this station is supposed to be more down the middle, but you get these reporters on here from Inquirer, Business Occurring, and it's always one attack one way. Everyone knows the person who went over there to file a lawsuit, him, Chris Smitherman, and the lawyer, they all connected. Why can't we hear that story? Thank you.
Thanks, Shakur, for the call. We appreciate that and always welcome you to offer your perspective on holding us accountable as well for the way that we frame stories. But he does raise a point that John Cranley had a phone that apparently took a dip in a hot tub, and so we don't necessarily know, or were they able to retrieve these messages?
I don't know that they've had a reason to try. I think anything that has been connected with this lawsuit was post Harry Black they were retrieving from January the 1st of last year through the end of October, I think.
That sounds right.
So I don't know if there's been a reason to try. But even I think we've been told that sometimes, even though you think you've deleted text messages, they live someplace if you want to try to find them.
Sure. I mean, I think no one is excluding the mayor from these requests. I mean, we have requested them. I know Sharon Coolidge, our City Hall reporter, has put in a lot of public records requests for a lot of this information. What has come out from the mayor has not been particularly interesting or enlightening. I mean, we wrote about, Sherry and I wrote something just a week ago about some of the comments that he had made via text. There was nothing that generated a huge amount of public attention related to those. There are other requests out there. No one is concealing them or not trying to get them. He just was not a party to a lot of these kind of conversations that were going on, at least in any way that we've been able to tell from text messages, from emails, and from that sort of thing. It doesn't mean those conversations weren't taking place, but, you know, maybe they took these things happen on the phone or in person, but, you know, we can't see that from the public information that we've received.
Jay, there was also news this week out of City Hall about marijuana. Tell us about that decision.
After several weeks of debate, council decided to decriminalize the possession of 100 grams or less of marijuana in the city. Now, that doesn't make it legal to use it on the street. You're still not supposed to have it. But if you were to be cited by a city police officer once this takes effect, the fine would be $0. There would be no jail time, and it's not a violation that you have to report on an employment application as an arrest.
So the legislation was opposed by a couple of members of city council, but for different reasons. We're talking about David Mann and Tamiya Denard. What were their different reasons?
David Mann's objection was the amount. He thought that 100 grams was too much. He was pushing for something closer to 28 grams, which I'm told is about an ounce. He was also pushing for to have an age restriction. That one proposal he had was 18 or over. Another one was 21 or over. The one that passed did not have that age restriction. Tamiya Denard's concern was that she was supportive of the idea, but her concern was that it needed to include language to go back and expunge or clear the criminal records of people who have been convicted of possession in the past. And supporters say they're working on that. It couldn't be included in this, but she wanted it put together, so that's why she voted no.
You also reported this week, Jay, on the police chief's reaction to a spike in violent crimes and deadly shootings in the city, a number of them since the end of May to now. What's going on?
He called it alarming, but he also at the same time said that they have a strategy that they believe in. They don't intend to change their strategy, and they're going to stick with that, you know, at least through the summer months. And at the time, I think there were 7 homicides in a 2-week period. I think at least today that increased. So I know at least 8, and there have been a couple more shootings, you know, since then. And that for the year, there's like should be, I think, around 135, 140 shootings.
It's interesting that we had this terrible tragedy not long ago on Fountain Square, where you saw such strong community reaction and coming togetherness about Cincinnati Strong and reacting to this type of violence. Are we seeing anything in that area or in that theme that's related to that? Because we've got more bodies than we had in that tragedy.
This has flown kind of under the radar in the last couple of weeks. And I think, understandably, to some degree, when you have a huge event on Fountain Square, a very public place where there's a mass shooting involving a gunman wandering around a public building, that's going to get a lot of attention and it's going to get everybody concerned. But the reality is these types of things, not mass shootings, but these types of shootings occur all the time. And you end up with, over the course of a week or two, with more fatalities than you had on Fountain Square shooting. But they don't get that attention because they trickle out, and council and city officials have not been speaking publicly really about this at this point. So it just flies under the radar a little bit.
Dan, there's one more piece out of City Hall I'd like to talk about as the city tries to deal with some budget issues. You reported that the city is looking to cut insurance coverage for erectile dysfunction medication for retirees. It would save, apparently, the retirement system about $425,000 a year. What exactly is going on here?
You know, it's been a week at City Hall when you're talking about Viagra, marijuana, and text messages involving former mayors.
What other beat would you possibly want to be on?
In this case, it has more to do with math than anything else. You know, the city is looking for ways that they can trim medical costs. They had been providing for some time impotence medication for retirees. In 2017, that figure added up to about $700,000 of coverage that the city had to pay as their share of that coverage, and they see an opportunity to cut about $425,000 of that if they eliminate that coverage. This could become part of a broader problem or issue between the retirees and the city, though, because the city had promised some years ago when they came up with a fix for the pension plan that they would not be significantly changing the retiree medical plan. Some of them may believe that we are getting to that point, not just because of this, but because of some other changes. The city's position is medical care changes all the time, drugs change all the time, plans change all the time, and this is just part of that.
I imagine that the $425,000 must be a reference to the cost of the plans and not exactly how much people are spending as retirees on this type of medication.
Actually, I believe it is related to this type of medication.
Really?
Yeah, that was my understanding, that they believe they can save $425,000 by eliminating coverage of this product for retirees.
Any reaction from retiree representatives?
No. I reached out to their attorneys. But again, if they reach a point where they feel, I don't know if this is the hill they want to die on or not, but if they feel that, you know, this is becoming a problem with the city changing their plans, they could go to court and challenge not just this, but some other changes that have been made over the years.
Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Dan Horn and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. What is the real cost of the new FC Cincinnati Soccer Stadium here in the city's West End? It could be more than $200 million over the next 20 years of operation. The Friday News Review continues now with the author of a new report, WCPO reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back to the program, Dan.
Cousin Mike, how you doing?
We're doing well. So glad you could join us today. You had to do a lot of math and analysis for this report as I was reading it over. I thought this looks like a lot of work and a lot of complicated analyses involved here. So first, just explain to us this $200 million number. Where does it come from?
Well, the original idea for this story was to compare FC Cincinnati Stadium deal to the deals on the riverfront for the Reds and Bengals. And then in order to do that story, I had to understand the deal itself. So I started reading the city's funding and development agreement and the the lease that they have with the Port Authority or the Port of Greater Cincinnati Development Authority. And then on top of that, you've got an agreement with Claremont County's port for a training facility. There's a community benefits agreement that's tied into this. So there are like 13 different documents that actually power the deal. And the more I learned about it, the more I realized that was the story. What's the cost of these contract clauses? And so that's basically what the story is. There's a searchable database where you can read the contract clause that requires some spending by either the team or the taxpayer. And then you can, there's an explanation in there for what that clause will cost and how we arrived at the estimate. The $213 million estimate is comprised mainly of financing costs, because the public infrastructure that the city and county agreed to build is going to be covered by bonds. They're going to borrow money to build that stuff. And so we counted not only the construction cost, but the cost of debt payments over time. And then the other big ticket item is the value of an exemption, because both port authorities structured the deal in a way that should allow the team to not pay property taxes on the land and the stadium improvements.
Well, as you were doing this exhaustive reading into all of these different documents involving multiple governments and quasi-government agencies, did you find that the number you arrived at was more than what the taxpayers expected?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I interviewed Jeff Birding, the president of FC Cincinnati, I asked him to summarize the deal, and he told me that it's $34 million in infrastructure spending by the city, And then more than $200 million in private investment by the team on the stadium site itself. And those are the numbers that are most typically used when you read stories about the stadium project, that it's a $250 million stadium that was made possible by about $35 million in public investments. And in some stories, you see that there's a county garage involved. Originally, that was supposed to cost $15 million. The most recent estimate I saw was that it's actually two garages that could cost $22 million, not including financing costs. So there has been mission creep over time. The actual number of the deal that was first announced in 2017, when the team was chasing an MLS bid, those numbers kind of stuck. But over time, a lot of different deals got added to the original MOU that enabled the team to, get the MLS attention.
Okay, so then to be clear, when we talk about $34 million in taxpayer contributions to this construction effort, your conclusion in this report is that over the course of the next 20 years, or at least when the stadium is operational, that number will actually exceed $200 million.
Right, that's my estimate. That's correct. And that comes from not only the contributions that were in the original deal that the city council approved in May of 2018, but it also includes the training facility in Milford, a $30 million facility that the team is privately paying for, but they'll receive a tax exemption on the property. And it includes, the deal with the port in Cincinnati or in Hamilton County. They have a very similar structure in their deal. That enables sales tax and property tax exemptions. If you add up all of those benefits to the team over a 20-year period, you come up with this number of $213 million.
So to be clear, to reach this calculation, we're not necessarily referencing money that's leaving the taxpayer coffers. Some of this is in reference to money that would have otherwise come into the taxpayer coffers had the deal not had the incentives.
That's right, yeah. And it also assumes that, if the team hadn't done the deal and they weren't spending $250 million on a stadium, there wouldn't be that much property to exempt, right? So this is kind of like an opportunity cost. It is money that the taxpayer or that the local governments would have if there was no exemption, but it's money that wouldn't exist if the team wasn't investing in the West End.
Dan, you said that the origin of this story was to compare the FC Cincinnati Soccer Stadium project to the two stadia on the riverfront, Great American Ballpark and Paul Brown Stadium. And it looks like you concluded in the reporting that the deal in the West End is better than similar MLS markets like Nashville and Columbus, but also better than those two riverfront ballparks. What does that mean?
Well, it's a lot better than the riverfront ballparks because the county owns the stadiums and leased them to the teams. In the case of the Bengals, they paid next to nothing for rent because the money they paid in the early years was to come back to them in the later years of the lease. And they've since traded those benefits for other things of value. So, you know, the Bengals aren't paying for their stadium. They're not paying taxes. Under the Port Authority's deal with FC Cincinnati, if the lease should end at some point, the way it's structured is a 360-day lease that can be renewed every year until 2070. If any time between now and 2070 the team or the port decide not to renew it, the team would take ownership of the stadium and they would pay taxes on it. So for a variety of reasons, FC Cincinnati's deal is a lot better for taxpayers than the two riverfront stadiums.
But you did find disparate answers about the benefits or dangers of this new stadium deal in the West End from obvious places. Team President Jeff Birding says it's good for taxpayers, while the group No More Stadium Taxes and its leader Jeff Capel dispute that. What are their respective characterizations?
Jeff Birding says it's a $450 million investment. If you count the team's $150 million franchise fee, what it's spending in the West End, what it's spending in Milford, he's saying it's up to a $450 million private investment that otherwise, you know, would not be possible if it were not for, you know, the team's willingness to build a stadium in the West End. Jeff Capel, who is a Blue Ash City Councilman and a critic of stadium subsidies, among other things, he says that it's a way around public opposition to stadiums. He says that taxpayers got wise after the riverfront stadiums were built. They don't want money being directly funded or directly funding stadiums. And so politicians had to come up with a sort of an end run around that opposition, and that's how he sees the Port Authority's structure for this stadium project. It's a structure that allows the team not to pay sales tax, not to pay property tax, and if you add up those benefits, it's a substantial benefit over time. It's like $4.4 million a year, I believe, is the figure based on a $175 million valuation for the stadium. And so, you know, what he's saying is that politicians know they can't get big subsidies past them, past voters. So they're structuring deals in a way that's less easy to understand and easier to hide the benefits that the team's being awarded.
My apologies to Jeff Capel for mispronouncing his name moments ago. I want to thank WCPO reporter Dan Monk for joining us and explaining this story. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Up next, a look at the news story detailing what is characterized as a hostile environment for Black students inside one local school district. And later, how bloggers are exposing sex abuse inside Protestant churches. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Racist messages are found inside a local school district's bathrooms. Racist drawings and notes of warnings against Black and Jewish students. A new report explores those issues at Lebanon City Schools. The Friday News Review continues with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Keith Birigolik. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
Keith, you found some pretty disturbing messages at Lebanon City Schools, some date from years ago. Why did this story just come out now?
Right. So, I mean, that was one of the main questions that we wanted to answer in the story, because there was a federal investigation by the Office of Civil Rights into the Lebanon City School Districts in the 15-16 school year. There were multiple families with Black and mixed race children had filed these complaints saying that there had, you know, there was a lot of these incidents happening. They felt unsafe in certain circumstances. So there was an investigation that took a while. Eventually that got settled. And then so I go in and try to get the records and what exactly did the investigation show? Because the school kind of said, we settled and we're doing some stuff. And that was about it. So then, you know, I got the results of that investigation, and that took more than a year to get because of the school arguing about privacy rights and different things like that. So it's coming out now because it's never been reported exactly what the environment was like.
Your story starts off with this description of a drawing made by an eighth grade student. It features a barn painted in the Confederate flag with the words "Welcome to Dixie" on its roof and a group of Klansmen standing near a burning cross. What was the story about that particular drawing?
So we don't have a specific story with that drawing. I couldn't tell you exactly what happened with that. So that was one of the things that the federal investigators found with the school district, is they said that the school didn't do enough to address racism. And when there were individual incidents, they didn't do enough to address the bigger picture. And that also involved some of the records that they kept. So they criticized some of the records, like were there enough details for us to even figure out what happened in here? A lot of times the details were very, you know, very slim, and it wouldn't exactly say what language was used. It would just say slur or bad language. So there was a lot of incidents like that where there were some details that, you know, were sort of unattainable, but you could tell, you know, a student had been punished, and you could tell there was something bad that had happened.
Did they detail what those punishments were for these students?
Yeah, so and that was one of the criticisms, was that discipline wasn't consistent, and that, I mean, there's one anecdote I detail in the story where there is an argument in the locker room, and there's a Black student talking about they're arguing about race, Black and white, and the Black student is talking about the NBA, and the white students say, you can't be in the NBA, you're too short, and it escalates to the point where a white student is saying, you know, well, the white race is better because there are no whites on plantations. And so this student gets in trouble. He acknowledges to the school, hey, I took things too far. That wasn't the right thing to say. So he says this in statements to the school. And then later his parents email the school. They complain about the punishment that he received. And the school, he had gotten a detention and in-school suspension. And the school rescinded that, gave him a verbal warning, and also gave the Black student a verbal warning.
So punished the Black student as well.
Yes.
Equally, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
What other type of racist imagery and messaging did you discover as part of this federal investigation?
So there were a lot of There were swastikas. There were references to KKK.
And these were written on parts of the school.
Some of them were on bathroom stalls, in lockers and things like that. Actually, in the 2015 school year, teachers were told it had gotten so bad and there had been so many messages like that, like go home, N-word, and things like that, that were written on the bathroom, that teachers at the high school were actually given a directive by the principal. Here's a list. Everybody has to check the bathrooms before the end of each class and between classes, because there were, you know, messages popping up so often that, you know, they were required to check each class to make sure there was nothing there.
So these were so prevalent that it became part of the daily task of teachers, that in addition to leading your work in the classroom, that you had to check to see if between bells there were new images left behind somewhere.
Yeah. There was actually a schedule of, like, you check this hallway, you check this part of the building, I'll check this part of the building. Yeah.
What type of work did the district do to change the culture within the school mm-hmm. district?
So that's one of the big questions that I tried to get at. And it's a little difficult to answer that. I mean, they changed their policies a little bit, so they more directly talk about racism and racial language and what's okay and what's not. And they started, you know, one of the things the federal investigation said is that the school would have assemblies and they would talk about bullying, but they would never talk about racism specifically. They would talk about bullying in general and harassment in general, but they wouldn't address specific things. So there would be like an Instagram post that seemed to threaten physical harm on minority students at the school. And the school couldn't figure out who posted this. So they said, well, we can't do anything about it. We don't know the student who posted it. Nobody's telling us who the student is. So they didn't do anything. They didn't, you know, call everybody in and talk about, like, here's why this is wrong, or here's, you know, they didn't do that. So they have done some of that. They have brought in diversity experts and speakers. I spoke to one of them who's worked in the Lebanon schools. So they have done some of those things. But I think with these kinds of what has been happening, I think that's difficult to change overnight.
You note that this district is 88% white in Lebanon City schools. Is there any concern about how a district with so little minority participation is able to navigate these challenges of fixing what appear to be institutionalized problems?
Well, sure. I mean, and that's one of the questions that people still have about the school district. I mean, the superintendent and the school board are all white. So there's certainly the question of do they understand exactly, you know, what it's like to be on the other end of some of this stuff? And if you don't understand that, can you really fix it? So certainly.
In a lot of ways, schools are representative of the communities in which they are located. And what has the reaction been in Lebanon outside of the schools?
Well, the reaction has generally been, you know, you were asking about what has the school district done since then? How have they improved, or have they improved? And I mean, judging from the reaction that I've gotten from parents and from people who live in Lebanon, it's that they haven't necessarily improved, that these sorts of things still happen. I mean, I was sent a picture of someone who lives in Lebanon. Right on their corner, there's a house where someone has one of those caricature black statues with big lips and big nose and that sort of thing, and the statue's holding a Confederate flag. And, you know, that's a reader who read this story and is sending me that and saying, look, it's right here, and it's not just the schools, and I took that picture today. So
I wanted to pull a graph out of your reporting. It says in 2016, a Democrat ran for Warren County Commissioner, where there hasn't been an elected Democrat since 1976. The party's chairwoman, this is the Democratic Party's chairwoman, spoke bluntly about his chances at the time in an interview with an Inquirer. Quote, he's black, said Beth Goldenfield. Quote, it's tough. So that sort of gives a glimpse into the general understanding of people within that community of their own community.
Right. I mean, it's hard to, you know, and I tried not to do this in the story where I make it seem like Lebanon is the only place in Cincinnati, is the only place in Warren County, it's the only place in Ohio where racism occurs. I mean, stuff like this happens everywhere. But
that was a party chairperson saying that, look, it's tough for Democrats in Warren County, which would have been a very obvious statement. It's like, this is tough for this candidate because he's black.
Right. And I mean, that's why I included it in the story, because I, you know, I remember talking to her for that story. And the story was just about how there weren't a lot of Democratic options for countywide positions in Warren or Butler County, which is what I cover. And, you know, talking, oh, here's this Democrat who's running for county commissioner. What are his chances? And I remember talking to the party chairwoman on the record. This isn't an off-the-record conversation or anything. And she says, he's black, it's going to be tough. And I mean, that's just it's kind of a shocking thing to hear in this day and age. But
there was a change in leadership in the school district over the course of the time that the federal investigation was ongoing to now when your report has come out. Mm-hmm. What does the district say publicly now about its situation?
So, I mean, the district says that it is trying to get better and that it has done a lot of things. It has changed its policies. It pays more attention to these kinds of incidents. And, you know, they are trying. One of the problems with kind of sort of the public statement of, you know, we're doing a lot better is that I'm not sure. That was one of the things also in the investigation that federal officials criticized was sort of some underreporting of the number of incidents that are happening. And so in the 2014-15 school year, there was 72 racial incidents that were reported. And so that's data that we have from the investigation of all discipline records. Looking through that data and picking out, okay, here the N-word is in this one. It's in more than half of the incidents. Race played a factor in this and this and this. So and then asking the superintendent, the new superintendent, how many racial incidents have you had since then? And he gives me the breakdown, and it goes from 72 the next year to zero, and then zero the next year, and then two this past year. So the numbers speak for themselves. I don't know if that's possible to go from 72 to zero. And I don't think any school in Ohio has zero racial incidents.
Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Keith Beery-Golick, thanks for being here and sharing this story with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. No one was paying attention until these armchair investigators came along. That's how the Washington Post described, quote, crusading bloggers who exposed abuse in Protestant churches. The story was featured in the Washington Post, and the reporter is based here in Cincinnati. Joining us now is freelance reporter Sarah Stancorb. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, thanks.
So how did this story come to be for you?
Well, I started researching it last August. I was connected through another story I reported on with one of the women in this kind of ecosystem of sex abuse advocates within Protestant churches. And she pointed out a couple of blogs to me. And once I started reading these blogs, I realized something extraordinary is happening here. And watched as stories that started on kind of these very basic blogger type old school blogs broke into local news, sometimes national news, sometimes globally. And it obviously was a means through which survivors were coming forward. And it was giving power to these survivors who weren't being heard otherwise.
We've known for decades about the mm-hmm. widespread sex abuse across the Catholic Church. What do we know now about abuse in the Protestant churches because of what these Christian watchdog bloggers have done?
Well, I mean, I think it's naive to believe that abuse would only exist in one denomination. For this story, and it didn't make it into the piece, I interviewed Boz Chavidian, who is a child sex crimes prosecutor, also Billy Graham's grandson, and he runs an organization called Grace. And they do external investigations of churches. He explained to me that back when the Catholic Church abuse stories first started breaking within Protestant churches, there was a lot of patting on oneself on the back, saying like, oh, well, thank God that's not happening here, which is simply naive. But as time has gone on, it's very evident that it is happening also within Protestant churches. But there are slightly different ways of covering up these stories.
Who are these bloggers?
They are mostly stay-at-home moms. They are women who stumbled into abuse stories within their own churches. So the main source within the story is named Darlene Parsons. She goes by D online. And she kind of fell backward into this when a youth minister at her church was accused and arrested and later convicted of abusing a number of boys. What she only found out later was that a friend of hers whose son had had interactions with this man had warned the church a year prior to the arrest. And she kind of became an advocate within her own church and eventually ended up blogging because it became evident people did not want to listen.
Sometimes there's criticisms of blogging when compared to traditional media outlets because of fact-checking and vetting, and anyone can throw up a blog. How did these women develop that trust with their readers so that they believed what was being reported?
Right. And I think part of it is it's been years that they've been doing this, so they've proven themselves over time. Dee Parsons was given advice early on that she could not be sued so long as she was telling the truth, as she understood it to be the truth. So to protect themselves, they spend quite a bit of time with these survivors and ask them to tell their stories in detail. They accumulate background documents if they're available and have over time learned how to vet stories.
So what have the results been? Criminal prosecution, resignations?
In some cases, for the most part, I think that one of the larger stories that listeners may have heard about was Jules Woodson's case, which broke first in the blogs and then kind of went all over the world. Her youth pastor back in Texas when she was 17 in, I think, 1998, had assaulted her when she came forward on the blogs. He eventually admitted something had happened, but later, as pressure from the media came upon him and the church, he did end up resigning, as did the pastor at his church who hired him with full knowledge.
I want to read part of your reporting. These fellow watchdog bloggers keep returning to their computers because the stories keep coming. In the process, they lighten others' loads by risking the same reproach, fear, and self-doubt the survivors feel. And isn't that the measure of a church anyway? Not thousands in pews or secrets held in shame to protect the powerful, but a community of people with shared faith who care enough about one another to build sanctuary. We have about 30 seconds, and I'm curious whether it seems that these bloggers have carved out a place of authority on this topic now, and that those coming forward prefer that these women are the ones who tell their stories?
I would say definitely. And I think it was extremely telling at the Southern Baptist Convention this week that outside the rally this year was much more populated and included a number of these bloggers, and the demands these bloggers and other advocates have been making have finally started to peter into the convention. It hasn't been adopted completely, but they're getting somewhere.
Cincinnati-based freelance reporter Sarah Stancorp, her reporting is currently in the Washington Post. We've got a link at WVXU.org. Sarah Stancorp, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Restrictive abortion bans become law in Kentucky, Ohio, and other states. We look at how the new so-called heartbeat laws will affect women seeking abortions. Will they be forced to travel across state lines? What health and legal risk does that pose? And what exactly is the role of the Federal Reserve in the U.S. economy? We'll preview an event coming to downtown Cincinnati Monday at noon on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.